January 21, 15 HMT.
Try cut and paste.
So in the room we have Cam Sharp, Doug Garlitz, Ted Holmes, Tammy Mackey, John Thorpe, Chris Walker.
Kelly. Has joined the conference.
And Andrew Traylor. We just joined?
I'm not sure, but there's a whole bunch of static.
That's what I was
doing. That's my phone. This is Jeff Ziller. Kelly's with us. Let me call back in. Get a different line.
Sounds good.
Kelly
has left the conference.
Yeah, those are fun.
Yeah. Oh, that's Andy doing that.
Don't look at my password, Dave.
So you guys live down in Eugene?
Yeah, I know your jacket. I can see
you
all of
that. Did you read the Register Guard?
Yeah.
Did you see this article?
Yeah.
Which one?
That's the one about Lieberg?
No, I heard about it. I wanted to.
This article is pretty supportive of what they're doing.
Oh, yeah.
We got this wacko call yesterday. One of your neighbors down there. I had to go hunt her back down. I did a reverse search on the phone number and then
went to
Facebook. She's been arrested by Lane County several times. Dr. Deborah Frisch. See that name? Occupy Eugene.
Oh, one of them. Yeah.
Civic Stadiums.
Yes. This is David. If this is an interesting story,
has joined the conference.
Oh. Actually, it's in reference to harassment calls at the hatchery, but there's an article that was in the Register Guard on Sunday. I should pass around. It was done by one of the journalists, the news reporters there for the Register Guard. It's real good. Talks about all the work, and it doesn't point fingers at anybody. Just looks at the big process. Interviews a number of different people, and it's a pretty good picture.
This was in relation to the dam break?
Yeah, and the water failure at Lieberg, and then also the problems they've had at McKenzie as a result of that. It led into comments from the public that immediately went after the 11,000 dead fish in the ditch and all sorts of stuff and pointing, but it had nothing to do with the article. It's just in Eugene, and you got to respect the territory.
That's ubiquitous. They're called internet trolls. Thank you, though.
So I think
that's some really good
Jeff
pictures
on
it too. That's like I took behind the dam where it's just completely empty.
Great. Yeah.
Right. Okay. Stuff.
So let's get started. First thing is minutes from December. I don't recall if we received any comments back from the group or not. At this point, are there any other kind of last minute comments that we'd want to include?
I guess I just had a question for you. Maybe this is for Chris or Tammy. As we walk through these action items, do they ever drop off the notes, or do they just sort of stay there?
If we do them.
Yes, they drop off. Once the status is complete, that will be noted in the notes, and then the next agenda will not have those on there.
And I'm actually not going to go through all of these because we're going to be talking about them today, and I'm hoping we can cross a bunch of them out today, at the end of the day anyway. So. That's kind of how we're working it, and I think it'll at least force me to do my action items. So moving on to action items, like Dave said, there's a number of them on here. We're not going to talk about all of them. So I'll just go through the ones that were specific to our last meeting, and then we can discuss the other ones as we go through the agenda. The first item that I have that's on the list is item 2.8, which John, you were going to send some sort of cost estimate for...
Yeah. Gosh, we moved right on to it. That apparently is dead in the water. Andy told Brett that the window of availability on that money is closed. And so we're working... Brett's right now working at using his own O&M and starting to work on it. So we're working on it, but we're not going to be sending you a cost estimate.
Okay.
It's because I don't think... We don't believe you have any money to help us.
Yeah, that was for like kind of non-routine action items.
Yeah,
top five list and we sent that off.
And to top that off, we just had a major non-routine action up at Liebrig, so I'll take the money to sort of sucked away.
Yeah, but it sounds like Fred has enough to
it's something he can do. Perfect. Would have been nice to have somebody else come and do it, but they can do it. Mm-hmm. Cool. They'll hire contractors for what they can't.
Yeah. Awesome.
Perfect. So moving on.
Hey, Andy, we lost connection with your screen.
I know. I was doing secret stuff, so I stopped sharing my desktop. I'll bring it back up here in just a minute.
Okay. Shows that Lance Kruzik is the host.
Kelly Reese.
Lance, I'm looking at your desktop. Yeah, if I was right, I can change that.
Moving on to item 2.9, having to do with sampling and pit tagging at South San Diego. Dave, you're going to check on this item. Any update on
that? Yeah, I wouldn't mind talking about it for just a second. Maybe Cameron has some thoughts.
Sure.
I was asking both Rich and Fenton about this, and neither one of them really knew what it was even about. So anybody have any information about this?
Specifically what? We're pit tagging any fish we're outlining.
It says that we will be around this time period, there will be a large number... No, I'm sorry, there will be pit tagging going on at South San Diego, and both neither Rich nor Fenton seemed to have any thoughts on what this was about, because it was really about needing, would Brett Boyd's crew need additional help, I think, to do pit tagging.
So we had agreed a couple of years ago to pit tag outplanted fish. The first winter steelhead came back, so I gave Brett a couple of racks of pit tags, and he's tagging them as he goes.
This is adult fish, so it'll be outplanted then, okay.
Right. So the sticking point was that we'd anticipated using the whoever was going to be doing steelhead spawning surveys above Foster as the crew to pit tag and sample steelhead as soon as large numbers started to show up. Since the spawning surveys on steelhead above Foster was dead in the water, I don't have any staff that can man the trap with the hatchery guys and do all of the sampling that's necessary. So it's catch as catch can. We've got Brett keeping up as well as he can, getting a tag in them and recording the sex, and that's it for the fish going up.
Are we... As of right now, are we losing data because there is a lack of manpower?
I think it would be a good idea to collect at least basic biological data, the size of the fish, scale samples from at least a subsample. But without people to actually do that one at a time with the fish, we're getting enough to know how many fish are going up and where they're being out of money.
Yeah, and maybe this... and we can talk about this when Chris and Andy get back to the office, but it might be something that we look, if somebody else from the O&M crew has got some, can potentially lend a hand if needed.
Sounds good. A couple of the other items were just data requests. Item 2.10 was the cougar trap sheet, which Andy sent out to the entire HMT. And then 2.13 was some data that Lance Kruzik requested for discussion today, which Cam Sharp had sent out to the group, so we can cross those off. And
Something good.
Does.
Chris, can I go up to action item 2.1, the very first one, for just a sec?
Sure.
The underneath status where it says University of Idaho is still working up the genetic data, that is correct. I don't know if you guys know, but Chris Cuddell has undergone, I think, some kind of open heart surgery, but it wasn't any kind of emergency thing. It was a planned surgery, but it's obviously slowed him down a little bit. But what I have just heard recently is that, at least for the Willamette Science Review, he or a member of his team will have pretty preliminary information on that steelhead genetics work that they are currently working on to present there. But again, it's preliminary, but they are working on it.
And if there are any other action items that I skipped that anyone wants to talk about now, let me know. Otherwise, we'll move on to our agenda. All right. So, Dave, did you have a chance to talk to Ryan from PNNL, who is next?
Oh, I talked told it to call in at about 10 o'clock.
10 o'clock?
Yeah. You're not allowed to know what time it is.
Yeah. Okay. So we'll do our updates, and by 10 o'clock you should be on, and we'll go from there. So, Greg Grandmember, you're up first with Marion Forks and Minto.
All right. As most people can figure out, Marion Forks is having a very, very mild winter. We're going to schedule to pond our first group of Chinook tomorrow, which is about a month earlier than I've ever seen it. We're a couple degrees warmer every day, and just the incubation process has been sped up quite a bit. So we'll start ponding the first group of Chinook tomorrow. The last groups will be ponded late next week. Water quality's been good. Pathology was out last week, and everything there was cleared and looked good. So they're rolling around just fine. Pinto, we have a little over 500,000 Chinook here. We had pathology checks here last week. 1 out of 10 Moorabun fish had BKD, which is a lot better than the 40% we saw last year. We're feeding a double vitamin pack, and with the warmer water, we're really pounding the feed to them. Now mortality's really low, and the fish look real good. Here too, we're seeing increased growth. Our fish are around 11 to the pound, which is normal, is a little bigger than normal. We're going to schedule two releases, an early to mid-March and then an early to mid-April. We've got two different tag groups, and we'll split the 680,000 molt in half and have two release groups. But river levels come down, clarity's clearing up. We're hoping to expect a winter steelhead any day.
All right, any questions for Greg? All right. South CNEM, Foster, are you going to...
Yeah. There's nothing.
Okay.
Everything's cool. well, sort of. They got their new truck. That was probably the biggest event, and the lid to the truck is as bad as any of the other lids. Andy was up playing with it. So we're looking at a way to fix that thing. It's just a design that looks good on paper until you pick it up. And it doesn't want to open. It pivots around a central hinge instead of a big piano hinge and wants to wobble if it's anything less than 90 degrees or flat. So,
is this something that we'll probably modify in the future, or is it something we'll live with, do you think?
They'll fix it.
Okay.
It's not livable. Okay. So that's not a big deal. And they got the same kind of Crowder stuff. I thought Greg was going to talk about Crowder problems at Minto, but Foster's got problems with the mechanics, but the maintenance crew was supposed to be out this morning to start working on it, so that's, Brett's pretty optimistic they'll get all that stuff fixed. So things are going pretty good there. They had some little bit of what they call Pseudomonas, which is a pretty ubiquitous internal bacteria outbreak with the sediment that came down. I don't know if you guys have seen the Sandy Am, but at least yesterday it was lovely milk chocolate colored and really high. So there's a lot of crud coming in. But it was not major, and they've resolved it. It'll probably just go away when the water clears up a little bit. So it's things are going pretty good. I've had basically nothing coming from Brett, so that's a good sign.
Okay.
All is quiet.
All right, Kurt and Kinsey.
Oh, yeah.
Let's see. You guys want to talk about water supply and stuff? I didn't say notice was out there, but we're good at our water supply. The canal was turned off on December 29th. If I got that date right, that's close. Anyway, and so the canal at that time had no inflow into it. Our main intake is on the canal. The only inflow was from side creeks. It maintained itself for quite a while there until it kind of dried up after that initial rainstorm near Christmas. And so we started, basically our demand was draining the canal a bit, so we adjusted flows and stabilized the canal. Moving those fish to the Rao River was a good thing. That freed up 8 ponds that we did not have to supply water to. Obviously, the only bad thing was an accident on the highway where 11,000 fish ended up on the highway.
Hey, Kurt, were all of the fish moved to Rao River or just a portion of them?
216,000. So I still have 609,000 on hand.
Are those Rao fish coming back?
Coming back? No, they were released, direct release into the Rao River.
Well, they were. I'm sorry.
Those fish were the fish above and beyond any potential release into the Mackenzie this year.
Correct.
You know, it's that. So you know, we've got. He was rearing the mitigation number, and so that was supposed to be about 230,000, I think, to go out, because they were definitely, no matter what, they were not going to go into the Mackenzie River this year, and so that's why they were picked to leave.
We were supposed to find a euphemism for that, and I came up with unsanctioned.
Unsanctioned fish.
We did go over there. We had about 88,000 tags in them, so there'll be some monitoring of those, of that release.
Before the all this happened, before December 29, how many total fish were on station? Wasn't it like 800 and some thousand?
838, something like that.
Right. Okay.
So, looks like E-Web is going to start filling the lake either Thursday or Friday-ish. They've got all the testing that they've been doing, and they're still testing a little bit on those roll gates, but it looks positive. They were able to remove a lot of the sediment that was in front of the fish ladder there where the fish enter the lake. So that's good, because that was just piled up with silt and stuff. So they were able to remove a bunch of that, so that should help out maybe some of that fish passage there. Let's see. Get back to the stuff that's happening recently. We have some good fish health going on. When we first were going to start to slow down these fish that were on a growth pattern for later, a little bit earlier release, I should say, we had some gray tail problems, but that seems to have diminished. We're in really good shape with our health, fish health at the moment. We ponded all of our 2314 fry, spring Chinook fry, so those are all in the pond. So the last group went in on Sunday, so we have 660,000 fry on hand also. And that was kind of pretty much normal for us, you know. The ponding seems to be January now, then it used to be a little bit in December, but with I can't attribute this totally to the cougar water control stuff, but it seems that after that went in, we've been ponding more in January than we used to. In fact, starting our ponding in January. Maybe it's just a cyclic thing for the whole weather pattern. I don't know. But anyway, that's when we were doing it. Greg mentioned how they were early up there. I think we're about normal, maybe just a little bit early. And what else do I got written here? That's about it, unless anybody has any questions.
Kurt, sorry about the confusion about the fry sampling equipment, but did I send you the pre-printed labels for the fry samples for the otolith vouchers, or did you make up your own?
Yeah, I've got the samples right here, Cam, and yes, there are some there. Yeah, they all have the labels on them.
Okay, because I had the labels on my desk, which suggested to me I hadn't sent them to you yet. But good, so otolith samples from the vouchers occur everywhere.
So we've got. Are those guys going to drop by and pick them up? Do you think
today?
Okay. We got the tracking of these the markings too. That'll have some paperwork for you too.
Perfect.
Any other questions for Kurt?
Kurt, with the roll gates working now, do you think there's a possibility that we could request particular operations? I'm thinking in terms of attempting to get more guidance of adult fish through the left ladder with the trap.
You know, they in the past they've done some of that. You know, I'm not really being able to talk for E-Web. I don't know if they would collaborate or not with us on that. They might.
Hey Cam.
Yeah.
The right bank ladder roll gate is slammed shut, so we're going to get more water coming off of that left side no matter what.
Perfect.
Yeah, well, let's hope they are a little bit more prudent in getting that one repaired also, though. maybe it'll be ready by this collection season.
Well, they didn't repair everything?
No, just one. They had let everything slide until they didn't have anything left.
Because the lake was empty. Oh, I didn't realize that. Okay. Well, still, that does work out. It's the right roll gate. They increase a dull passage through the left bank ladder.
The correct roll gate.
The most convenient roll gate.
That'll allow us to capture some more of those hatchery fish in September, if indeed they all are passing that way.
Yes.
Any other questions for Kurt?
Yeah, hey, related to that Lieber Dam trapping of hatchery Chinook, you know, when details get worked out there, I hope folks will share it with the group. I'd like to take a look at it, whatever the plans are for this season.
I would certainly hope this group helped develop that plan. So, yes.
Good. Yep.
All right.
Maybe that could be something for next meeting, or somebody could take a stab at it, offer out a straw man or something.
Good, I'll do that. So I'll put together an agenda topic for next meeting with a straw man.
Sounds good. And I'll get it on the agenda. All right, anything going on at Cougar Trap? Not a whole lot, right?
No.
And he's speaking for Dan Peck.
Yeah, Willamette. Actually, Willamette has not been on the screen for weeks and weeks. Everything is going fine. Big, big thing, same thing. Their fish are about a month early. Everything is early, early, early.
Yeah, so, he's never seen it that early.
Yeah, it's just times are changing. So it's, but yeah, other than that, they got cold water picked up in one pond, but that's just one pond for some reason. And that'll be go away, and they'll treat it. Everything. See, it's this winter is really pretty easy this year, unless we get the rain that we need or snow. Things are pretty good. I mean, they had some issues, damage in the intake, 2 months ago, but that's been adjusted for, and everything's fine. Mm-hmm. We're still looking at construction work and plans to rebuild that intake structure, but that's a big dollar cost, and so we got to get that all together. But that's some point it's got to be done, but we don't know what's going to happen, and you know, it worked. And we need to meet sometime with the production folks and talk about what we're going to do with Willamette and Lieberg and McKenzie and everything as far as long range goals.
Okay.
Will the Willamette structure rebuild be tied in with the increased capacity in the holding pond for broodstock?
The whole mess of things, yeah. A new adult pond, okay. Right. That's first time it was estimated was, you know, $3 million, I think. Huge cost, but it was the Taj Mahal broodstock pond, and
we have designs ready.
Yeah, but
no money.
No money. I mean, it's a lot of money. I don't know that. No, we need to do that. We've the design on the intake structure would include changing the plumbing to the ponds to be able to pass more water, but to get more water, we increase our water rate, we trigger passage requirements, and then fish go above the hatchery intake, and that's a potential, you know, problem. So that, you know, there's ground there, and there's water in Salmon Creek to increase production at Willamette. All the other things that when you do that causes all sorts of grief, and so I don't know what we're going to do. We got to meet and discuss. That's going to change how we go, whatever's going to happen. Other than that, life at Willamette's pretty normal.
How about Lieberg? They were hit with the same issues that McKenzie were hit with. Lieberg?
Lieberg. Yeah, well, you've seen them in the news. Lieberg, same problem. Their difference is that they have the capability to pump water out of the McKenzie River to supply the hatchery. And that's one issue. Lieberg, when the dam loses level, there is no water.
Ryan Harnish
has joined the conference.
There's no way for them to get any water, so they don't have to back up like Cogswell Creek. But you've got the ability to run suction hoses into the McKenzie, pull water, put it at the intake lines, and keep the hatchery going. And we lowered some of the loading densities by stocking some fish out last month, and they're running the pumps. It's It seems to be pretty stable. We're taking one of the pumps back. The Corps gave us a pump last week and got it in place. It's working fine, so we're going to stop paying rent on one. It's just bleeding money down there, but it works fine. Now, Mackenzie, on the other hand, if it ever loses Cogswell Creek back up in the canal, it'd be really hard to pump water out of the Mackenzie River. Have you thought about doing that, Kurt?
About pumping from the Mackenzie?
Yeah, there's no way you could pump water to keep those fish alive, is there?
I don't think we could.
Yeah.
No, it'd be a huge cost, more so than what Lieber's doing, because we'd have so much more distance to pump.
Oh, yeah, you'd have to all the way from the discharge point back to the top, whereas Lieberg, it's not easy, but it's a doable thing. Lieberg will be fine.
Well, Lieberg has an open canal, too, you know, to supply the hatchery, and ours is all underground piping.
Yeah, yours is modernized.
Yeah, so it'd be real difficult to pump. We considered if we lost the canal level farther and farther, that we would pump out of the remaining water in the canal if necessary and pump it right into our intake. We never got to that point, thankfully.
Yeah, it's that. The truth is that Cogswell Creek will keep you going for a while. It's just that that's Lieberg is it's much easier to treat like this. It's just a pain to do it that way. So, but everything else seems to be going
okay. The timing on this too, you know, it happened here in the winter where we have rain. If this happened in midsummer, we'd be in a tough situation here. If they shut the canal off and no inflow into the canal to keep that canal level up, we'd be in trouble here, I would think, because Cogswell Creek would also be below 5 CFS also.
Yeah, you probably would have been in trouble in about 72 hours.
I would think so.
Yeah, that's so. Mm-hmm.
We'd have full production and adults on hand and everything, so it could be a real tough situation.
So, but anyway, Lieberg is you know, struggling along with pumps, but the pumps work.
Okay.
Everything's going. Hopefully we'll start getting water. This last weekend when it rained, the water level actually came up to the bottom of the intake structure, to the bottom of the screens, with the dam wide open.
Oh, okay.
There was that much water coming in. And so Andy, you've talked to potential water managers, and mm-hmm. we might be able to get some continued release out of the dams upstream.
Yeah.
If they shut those gates, I think it'll fill up real fast. I think it's supposed to rain again tomorrow, too. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what they're hoping. They might drop it a little bit right now and then bring it back up around Thursday or Friday. Or they might drop it now and then leave it at a level that they can maintain through maybe Monday, if possible. But it looks like once we get some more rain after Monday, they're going to have to drop it back down and just passing in flows again.
Okay.
So hopefully that's enough over the weekend to bump it back up.
Yeah, it sounds like the last time this happened, like in 2011, E-Web had estimated it was going to take 2 weeks to fill up the reservoir, and it took 2 days. This weekend it rained, and the reservoir started to fill back up again, even though they were spilling it as most they could. So it's not a real deep, huge reservoir, so it's... In fact, if you go up and look at it, the difference between where it is now and full would be like maybe 10 or 15 feet. So it's not a real huge place.
Okay. Fish counts, then it's not operating.
It's not really happening yet. It's not very exciting.
When do we usually set that up?
Like it's all set up.
Oh, okay.
All upper Bennett is 24/7, 365. Lower Bennett will get set up in May.
Oh, okay. That's what I was thinking. All right. All right, for the next item, we have a presentation from Ryan Harnish. Dave, you want to kick this one off?
Yeah, sure. I asked Ryan Harnish from PNNL if he would be kind enough to share the results of the 2014 work that PNNL did in the South Saniam in relation to looking at hatchery summer steelhead and potential interactions, overlaps in time, et cetera, with the natural origin Oncorhynchus population in the South Saniam. And this follows from a 2013 study that PNNL did, in which you guys remember Jeff McMichaels was the lead author. You guys probably all know this, he left PNNL and has gone on to private consulting. And Ryan worked with him in 13, and so Ryan took the reins in 14 and was following up from the 13 study. And in fact, Ryan, if you'd be kind enough, maybe just explain some of the things that happened in 13, which led you to change some of the study design in 14, and then go ahead and take it away from there.
So in 2013, we radio tagged 200 summer steelhead at South Saniam Hatchery, and we had a relatively high percentage of those fish not leave the hatchery volitionally. I think it was around 24%, I want to say. And that was using a 4-gram tag. And of those that did leave, we saw about 20% or so make it down to Willamette Falls, with the majority, about 60% or so, remaining in the South Saniam Hatchery, remaining in the South Saniam River. And we also did some snorkel surveys to look at behavioral interactions between hatchery steelhead and wild omicus, and found that there was a fair number of hatchery fish residualizing in the South Saniam and occupying the same habitats as wild omicus. The hatchery fish were typically quite a bit larger than the wild fish and dominated the majority of the interactions that we observed between the two. So in 2014, we wanted to basically replicate the radio telemetry portion of the study using a smaller tag, hoping that we could reduce the proportion of fish that remained in the hatchery, and also, again, looking at the interactions, behavioral interactions using snorkeling, and Jeff had this idea that we would try to do some manipulations by removing, so if we encountered a hatchery and wild fish occupying the same habitat, the same pool, trying to remove the hatchery fish from its feeding location and then observe the response of the wild fish to see whether or not the presence of that hatchery fish was precluding the wild fish from occupying a habitat that they otherwise would have in the absence of the hatchery fish. And we also wanted to sort of do a little bit more, cover a little larger spatial scale with our snorkeling to look at densities of hatchery and wild fish and how those changed as you move farther away from the hatchery. So that's what we did in 2014. We tagged 200 radio tag fish. So I guess we can get the the slides going here.
Hey, Ryan, this is Andrew Traylor. I'm currently the host on the web meeting. Do you want to become the host?
Sure.
And run it from your desktop?
Estimate the proportion of hatchery summer steelhead that residualized in the South Saniam using the radio telemetry data. Determine the extent to which hatchery and wild omicus overlapped in space and time, and then to characterize the behavioral interactions between hatchery and wild omicus. We intended to tag 200 hatchery summer steelhead. We had one faulty tag, so we ended up only tagging tagging 199. Again, we used a smaller tag this year. Weighed 2.1 grams in air, 5 second ping rate, and 125A tag life. Those fish were tagged at the South Sandyam Hatchery on April 1st, held overnight in buckets in the raceway, and then released into the raceway with the general hatchery population the next day. And then volitional releases began on April 23rd. University of Idaho deployed and managed the fixed station receivers, which are shown on this map here as the red dots. So the one right here on Foster Dam, one down at the mouth of the South Sandyam, at the mouth of the Sandyam River, view in the Willamette River between the Sandyam and Willamette Falls, and then a series of receivers down around Willamette Falls. We also did mobile tracking this year. Last year, in 2013, we weren't able to determine whether or not the fish that remained in the South Sandyam died or whether they had residualized. So this year we wanted to do some mobile tracking to try to get fate determination of the fish that remained in the South Sandyam to determine whether or not they residualized or died in the river. So we had a couple different mobile tracking trips. ODFW kindly loaned us a raft and some other gear, and we floated from Foster down to Waterloo Park on two different occasions. Anytime we detected a fish, we attempted to agitate it by holding the raft in place over it, splashing the oars around, making a lot of fishermen pretty angry doing that. And so then we estimated the residualization rate, and this is really the minimum residualization rate because we weren't able to get fates of all the fish that that were not detected on the fixed stations leaving the South Sandyam River. So we estimated it as the number detected alive during mobile tracking divided by the number that volitionally left the hatchery. And then we also looked at the effect of fork length, weight, condition factor, and tag burden on the migration probability using likelihood ratio tests. The direct observations, snorkel surveys, we did on four different occasions. In 2013, we focused our efforts primarily around McDowell Creek Bridge and Waterloo County Park, and didn't have any trouble finding hatchery fish to observe their interactions with the wild omicus in those areas. We had a little bit harder time finding hatchery fish in those areas this year, so we also did some snorkeling around right around the hatchery there, and then also during one of the mobile radio telemetry tracking trips, we'd get out and snorkel at several locations between the hatchery and Waterloo Park. We identified each fish we saw, the species, its origin for omicus, whether it was wild or hatchery, based on adipose clips and estimated approximate lengths. We recorded all our behavioral interactions using GoPro videos and then analyzed those back in the office, looked at the number and type of interactions, origin and size of the interacting fish, which fish initiated the interaction, which one dominated, whether or not the subordinate fish was displaced. And then we classified the interactions as threats, crowds, chases, nips, or butts. Calculated an interaction rate as the total number of interactions per fish per minute, and also, like I mentioned, looked at catch per unit effort, which was estimated as number of fish observed per minute, and then looked at spatial trends using general multiple linear regression models. So, moving on to the results here. So, again, we had a pretty high percentage of the radio-tagged fish not volitionally emigrate from the hatchery. 35 out of 199 of them stayed behind. Didn't find any significant correlations with those that didn't immigrate to weight, fork length, condition factor, or tag burden. Of the 164 radio tag fish that did leave the hatchery, 40% were detected outside the South Sandingham River, with 12 of those last detected near the mouth of the Sandingham River. 53 were detected in the Willamette, with 41 of those successfully making it all the way to Willamette Falls, so only a quarter of the total number that emigrated from the hatchery made it to Willamette Falls. So the last known location for the majority, 60% of the radio tag fish, was in the South Sandingham River. Two of those were last detected at the mouth of the South Sandingham. 50 were last detected in the Foster Dam tail race. 14 of those that we know left the hatchery were never detected. So we have to assume that these fish either residualized downstream of Waterloo, since we didn't do any mobile tracking below Waterloo, or they died somewhere in the South Sandingham River and their tag was carried far enough away from the river that we weren't able to detect it during our mobile tracking surveys. And during those mobile tracking surveys, we detected 33 radio tag fish, and I'll get to those results here in a minute. So for the fixed station data, again, it's pretty similar results to what we saw in 2013, with about three-fifths to two-thirds of the radio tag fish being last detected in the South Sandingham River, and just about a fifth to a quarter making it down to Willamette Falls. Migration timing was a bit quicker in 2014, with all the fish that made it to Willamette Falls taking about 3 weeks to get there, compared to 4 weeks in 2013. Like I said, we detected 33 radio-tagged hatchery fish during our mobile tracking between Foster Dam and Waterloo Park, and those surveys were 3 months after release, so any fish that were detected, we assumed, were residualizing in the river. 21 of those 33 fish were found to be alive, and so that we consider this our minimum residualization rate as it applies to the radio-tagged population. And that comes out to be about 13%. If you were to apply that percentage to the total number of hatchery steelhead released from the South Sandingham hatchery, that would equal almost 24,000 residual steelhead. The majority of the residual steelhead that we found alive were found to be upstream of Pleasant Valley, so 15 out of 21 of those. We found 9 dead radio tagged fish. We didn't actually find the tags, but they were obviously out of the water. Saw a lot of osprey nests, and there were 3 with unknown fate. So this figure over here shows the locations of the fish that were detected alive in green, dead in red, and unknown in yellow, and the larger circle indicates more fish. So pretty highly concentrated closer to the hatchery. In both years, we found a significant effect of condition factor on the probability of migration to Willamette Falls, shown down here in the lower left for 2014 and for 2013. So fish with a higher condition factor were less likely to migrate to Willamette Falls. No significant correlations with any of these other variables, weight, fork length, or tag burden. We generally had good conditions for our snorkel surveys. Turbidity wasn't really a factor, and flows were pretty low. We observed hatchery steelhead alongside wild omicus on each snorkeling trip, and this figure here really just gives you an idea of the size difference between the wild fish shown in blue, which were typically 100 to 150 with some individuals a little bit larger, 150 to 200, and the hatchery fish being in the 200 to 250 range for the most part. We observed a trend of decreasing catch per unit effort for hatchery summer steelhead and increasing catch per unit effort for wild omicus with increasing distance from the South Sandyham hatchery. And there was a significant interaction between fish origin and distance from the South Sandyham hatchery. So farther away from the hatchery, higher catch per unit efforts of wild omicus and lower catch per effort of the hatchery fish. And this might be an issue since habitat doesn't appear to be uniformly distributed throughout the South Sandyham River. This is just a figure here showing the gradient of the river with higher gradient, more pool riffle type habitats up closer to the hatchery, and then there's more sort of long runs and glides once you get downstream of McDowell Creek. And typically we observed both wild and hatchery steelhead in those riffle pool type habitats. The behavioral interactions were fairly similar as far as the type goes between 2013 and 2014. Most were identified as threats, chases, and crowds. Relatively few nips and butts were observed, and that differs from some of Jeff's previous work in tributaries of the Yakima River, but it's likely due to the lower densities that we observed in South Sandyham compared to what he was looking at in those smaller tributaries. So larger fish typically dominated the interactions. 90% of the interactions were dominated by the initiating fish. 84% resulted in displacement of the subordinate fish. In the 19 interactions we observed between hatchery steelhead and wild omicus, hatchery fish dominated 16 of those, or 84%. About 62% of the interactions were initiated by hatchery steelhead, and they only accounted for about 29% of the total number of omicus observed. So the conclusions, results were similar between 2013 and 2014. The majority of the radiotenic hatchery steelhead either residualized or perished in the South Sandyham. We have did a minimum residualization rate of about 13% for the radiotagged population, and that was 3 months after their release. And again, that would represent about 24,000 hatchery steelhead residuals if it's applied to the total number released. Found migration probability was negatively correlated with condition factor in both years. Direct observations showed that hatchery steelhead were present in sympatry with wild omicus at most of the locations surveyed. Hatchery steelhead were typically more aggressive, initiated more of the interactions, and dominated those interactions with wild omicus. They were considerably larger than the wild omicus. And the radio telemetry results and the snorkeling surveys showed that the highest densities of residual hatchery steelhead were located in sites closer to within 10 kilometers of the hatchery, which may be an issue due to what appears to be a higher quality habitat located closer to the hatchery. And we observed what might be a potential meso habitat scale displacement of wild omicus by the hatchery steelhead. So, some of the limitations of the study. The sampling effort used to identify longitudinal trends in relative abundance of hatchery steelhead and wild omicus. This certainly wasn't a terribly robust method for looking for those types of meso habitat scale displacements would have been better to do survey more locations with more replication, both prior to and following release of the hatchery fish, and maybe tracking some individual wild fish might have also lent us into their behavior a little bit better. Spatial scale of our mobile tracking surveys was only was confined to the hatchery down to Waterloo Park, so we don't know anything about the residualization of steelhead downstream of Waterloo. The issue with the radio tagged fish not volitionally leaving the hatchery draws into question the representativeness of the tagged population to the general hatchery population. Like I mentioned, we had almost 18% of the radio tagged fish not volitionally migrate from the hatchery, compared to about 1% of the untagged population. However, regardless of that, the relatively large numbers of hatchery, residual hatchery steelhead that we saw during snorkel surveys indicate that that residualization of hatchery fish might be an issue. So, summary, we concluded that there is potential for negative ecological effects of hatchery summer steelhead releases on wild omicus, due to potentially high rates of residualization and the aggressive behavior and dominance of hatchery steelhead over the wild omicus. Potential management and research actions to consider would be reducing feed levels during the last month of rearing, which has been shown to work previously to try to reduce the condition factor of the hatchery steelhead prior to their release, which may result in higher portions of them migrating out more quickly and reduce the residualization rate. Any change like that would probably be good to reevaluate the residualization rate using radio telemetry. And currently have engineers here that developed the microacoustic tag. They're looking into the potential for using that same battery technology on radio tags. So you might be able to develop a small, about 0.2 gram radio tag that would last 100 days, and that might help to reduce some of that tagging effect that we saw that seems to be causing the radio tagged fish to remain in the hatchery. Might also be a good idea to estimate, try to come up with an estimate of the carrying capacity of the South San Juan River downstream of the hatchery to determine the appropriate number of hatchery steelhead to release. Tynes and Friesen recommended that the composite population of hatchery and wild not exceed the theoretical carrying capacity to try to avoid density-dependent effects. And that's all I had.
Any questions for Ryan?
Yeah, thank you very much. You can have a glass of water now.
Yeah, thanks. I'm kind of recovering from cold right now.
Yeah.
There was kind of a quick graph on flows. Were there any flushing flows or any sort of manipulation of water to try to get these fish to migrate during either of these 2 years?
Well, it looks like the volitional release started on the 23rd, which maybe coincides with this little bump right here. I'm not sure if Brett's on the phone. He might be able to answer that a little bit better.
He's not on the phone, unfortunately.
Ryan, this is Cameron. I haven't got much experience with juvenile snorkeling, but is the number of hatchery juveniles you saw while snorkeling consistent with there being 20,000 hatchery fish in that reach? Just got your gut on that? You think there were 20,000 fish in there?
know, that's difficult to answer, I guess. There was pools where we saw up to 20 hatchery steelhead hanging out. And those are just the ones that we could see floating along as we were on the surface. So, 20,000 is maybe a stretch, but it's, it was a pretty large number.
I guess I have some concern with calling it a minimum residualization rate when you have an obvious tag burden going on, and then you're extrapolating that to 20,000, but not having any discount of that potential tag burden influencing those fish to stay. It seems like just the messaging there is a little potentially confusing, because I think the tag burden, 18% versus less than 1% of untagged fish staying, that's significant. And so you never know what those tags could be doing to those fish that are staying in the river.
Right, yeah, I was careful to say in the report to say that that minimum residualization rate applies to only the tagged population. You're right that the extrapolation to the general hatchery population, there are some issues with that. However, that minimum rate also only includes the section of river that we floated while mobile tracking. So down to Waterloo Park, there could have been more of those hatchery fish that were residualized downstream of Waterloo.
Brian, this is Chris Walker. I'm curious if there's been research that you're aware of that looked at tag burden and behavior of fish in terms of fish not wanting to migrate, and if so, what that threshold might be, and if this new tag might help us answer that question, whether or not tag burden is important in terms of, I guess, teasing out the question that we want to answer versus it potentially being a tag burden effect.
Right. Well, I was a little bit surprised that we didn't see any correlation here with tag burden on the probability of migration for the fish that did leave, and even those that didn't. Maybe it's more of a handling effect. I don't know. It's hard to say. We've done a lot of tag effect type studies using with acoustic transmitters, and I've generally found there's sort of two trains of thought on it. Is that there's a backpack effect is what they call it, that it's like if you're carrying a 50-pound backpack, it doesn't feel too bad until you get a few miles in, and then all of a sudden it's wearing on you. And so survival and behavior might not be that affected in the near term or short term after tagging, and then it becomes a cumulative effect farther distance or time from tagging. Or it's that there's an immediate handling effect that happens, and those individuals get culled from the population immediately, or their behavior is altered shortly after the tagging event, and then they become more like your untagged population. But the difference between 2013 and 2014, we used a 4-gram tag in 2013, a 2-gram tag in 2014. It's half the size. If we go down to a 0.2-gram tag, I can't imagine that will have, less of an effect on these fish and allow them to behave more normally.
Gotcha.
Have you considered going with an acoustic tag? Because as I recall, the Cook Lab is going to be installing and maintaining some acoustic telemetry receivers through the lower river. Versus North San Diego releases.
Yeah, we considered it. acoustic telemetry doesn't work quite as well in shallower water, but there's, you know, there's plenty of deep holes that I think we could get it to work in the South San Yam. But I think the issue there is with the mobile tracking, and if you really want to get face on those fish, a little bit more difficult with acoustic telemetry.
Yes, this is Lance. One of the things that really jumped out to me on that thing, that the graph that you're showing right there, Ryan, is the size of those fish. And last time I really dug into residualization rates and looking at the work that they've done in Idaho, a lot of work there, you know, once you get above that 200 millimeter threshold, your residuals increase substantially, and it looks like almost, you know, nearly all of the fish, or the majority of them, are pretty big.
Yeah, and some of the work by Tipping, looking at condition factor, I think they found, you know, condition factor less than one. Those fish migrated out at a higher rate than fish with condition factor greater than one. And if you look at the distribution there, I mean, almost all the fish had a condition factor greater than one.
Yeah, right. Yeah, that's something we should, you know, as a team, we should look at a little more closely what the releases have been of the summer steelhead smolts. You know, are they typically this large a time at release? Are they growing quite a bit during the late spring, early summer? Kind of look at that. I don't think we've really looked at it in a while. Another question for you, Ryan. So the battery life of the 2014 tags, how many days was it again?
125.
Oh, okay. Yeah. That's... So if those fish were going to be wandering around, you'd have 125 days or so for them to show up at some of the other receivers, right? I mean, is that pretty standard that you get 125 days out of those tags?
Yeah, and we retained 10 of the tags from the fish that didn't leave the hatchery to monitor the tag life and make sure that it was what, you know, Lotec said it was going to be. And I think the first tag died after like 130 days or something. And we, University of Idaho, had those receivers running well past the end of our study, and we sort of used end of August as our cutoff. Whereby, you know, any fish detected after that, and I don't think we didn't have any fish detected past July something, so they definitely had plenty of tag life, and the receivers were operating through the end of the study.
Okay, good.
Were you able to calculate detection probabilities at the different receivers, especially the ones down by Malevin Falls?
We were not. Yeah, that was, you know, relying on someone else to get us the data, and not knowing a whole lot about those receiver stations. You know, it would have been nice if we were the ones in charge of that. I don't really have any kind of sense for what the detection range or anything of the receivers was. We did have some issues with, you know, like you always do with radio telemetry or any kind of telemetry with false positives. So we had to come up with some filtering rules, and we were able to improve the filtering rules this year because of the mobile tracking and having known locations of fish. So we used that subset of those 33 fish that we detected during mobile tracking to filter false positives from the fixed stations, which didn't change the results. We reanalyzed the 2013 data, and it didn't change the results much. But you know, you'd have a fish that skipped two or three receivers and was detected by a fixed station several times, and you know, whether or not it was they were false positives or what the issue was there, you know, there are some issues with with that fixed station data, I guess, but I feel pretty confident in the filtering rules that we were able to come up with using that mobile tracking data.
Hey, Ryan, this is Dave. How far away is PNNL from developing that smaller tag?
We just had a meeting about this a couple weeks ago, and the engineers, I believe their plan is to use low-tech tags that we currently have and just basically removing the battery and reconfiguring it with one of these smaller ones. I'm not sure how quickly they would be able to get, you know, a couple hundred or so or 100 of them made, but... you know, they're a pretty good crew over there. They could probably get something for this spring if it was necessary.
Yeah. I think we'd all agree this is a really interesting study you've done the last 2 years, and I think there's a lot of value in continuing to pursue something like this to try to understand really what's going on out there. You know, you brought up the issue of carrying capacity. I don't know if camera and float, we already know that information, or that's something that could be determined, but it, you know, there's a couple pieces that it would be great to fill in gaps, and absolutely it would be awesome to do this study again with more tag if we could develop that to try to really eliminate that that variable of tag burden if possible. But you know, Lance, you asked a question about, you know, the size of the fish that are released. I think, John Thorpe, you're on the phone, but, I mean, there has to be, I know there's an outdated HGMP from way, way back when for the summer steelhead program, but there has to be information that these folks, Brett and others, used when they rear those summer steelhead. They know what size they release them at. They know what size they're trying to achieve. I suspect they are pretty darn big because the whole theory was, the bigger they are, the quicker they're going to leave. But maybe that's something that needs to be revisited.
I don't think it's changed in a long time.
Yeah.
So it's, and you're correct. There's all sorts of data on that. And what's not easily available in our hatchery management information system, but I know is collected, is length frequencies before they release these things. So you can even get a better close idea of what these fish look like, and you could calculate
right.
Condition factors and things like that.
Yeah.
That should be definitely kind of a starting point. We should look at that data again and see what's feasible, you know, at the hatchery to, because maybe Cameron knows this stuff really well, but that residualization rate and size at release is huge. So I suspect that has a lot to do with what's going on.
Yeah.
Agreed. Remember, we've also got data coming this year from pit tag steelhead released from the South Sandy Island detections at Willamette Falls. So half of the fish that were released with pit tags are diploids. Half are triploids, that's the experiment. But the diploid release, that's production fish. And we have specific information about the size of those fish. So we can mine that and look at it. Do a comparison. What about pit tag detections down on Willamette Falls? If we can ever get a program in place to calculate capture efficiency at Willamette Falls, it's something we've been harping on. I think there is room to use pit tags, though, to specifically...
Cam, can you speak up just a tiny bit? I'm having trouble hearing you.
I think it'd be a good idea to get a good pit tag release group out of the production fish at South Sandy Am. Because then we would be able to know what the size distribution of active migrants and undetected fish is using the Willamette Falls detectors. So,
anyway, I think this is what PNNL has done is very interesting, and as I said, I think it'd be really important to continue to pursue some type of study along those same lines. And maybe if in the future we can look at some of that hatchery data and make some sort of changes to what the fish look like when they leave, then it'd be even more interesting to follow those fish and see what's going on. See if we can find some ways to reduce that residualization rate. So, yeah, I agree. We need to look at that sort of estimate of the hatchery release, estimate of residualization with a lot of caution, but still, it's quite clear that there is residualization. It's very clear also that those hatchery summer steelhead occupy the nice primal habitat that the omegas would probably like to occupy. So there are things going on that it would, I think, are important to try to get a handle on it and try to minimize.
Yeah, this is Lance, I agree. I mean, it's just, from my perspective, good management of the program to get the residual rate as low as we possibly can, because, I mean, the purpose is to return anadromous fish, not resident rainbows, to the fishery.
Yeah.
So hopefully we can do that, especially if we can start studying a significant management change, you know, if that's even possible. I don't know, with the water temperatures and such at Foster and the hatchery, if we can even slow those fish down much, I don't know, maybe the hatchery managers could speak to that on the feasibility of doing something significant there. It may not be there.
Yeah, that's true. Get those fish culturist guys to figure that stuff out. Well, hey, thanks a lot, Ryan. Really appreciate that. Does anybody have any further questions for Ryan?
Hey, one quick question. So that the resident omicus population, you know, those older age fish in the South San Diego, are they real prevalent or pretty rare? You know, the wild rainbow trout.
Well, whether they're rainbow trout or winter steelhead, hard to say, but you know, they're pretty prevalent. You know, we didn't have any trouble finding wild omicus. Just about any ripple pool that we snorkeled in.
But the larger size fish, you know, the 10 to 13, 14 inch rainbows?
Yeah, I didn't see a whole lot of those. You might see one every one or two pools that you snorkeled.
Okay, so most likely juvenile steelhead.
Small fish.
Yeah, okay.
This is Jeff. Do you have a feel for what percentage in each of the areas you had of like-size hatchery, steelhead, and the wild component? Do you have a proportion?
Of similar size?
Yeah.
It was pretty rare to see a wild fish that was, you know, greater than 200 millimeters out there.
That's what I was thinking, is that you have a very small component of fairly large wild fish, but you would have a large component of rearing fish. What kind of numbers are we talking about when in a typical pool you saw, you know, if you saw 10 hatchery steelhead, how many wild fish would you see?
I've heard that.
Fair amount of variability, sort of, depending on where you were at, but, no, I would say probably 30 to 40 wild fish.
There's a lot of overlap. So what I might end up doing is depending on...
Sort of just thinking out loud here, but, I mean, if the omicus population of wild fish below Foster is dominated by juvenile winter steelhead... You wouldn't expect
right
to see anything.
There's a couple voices in the background. It's getting hard to hear this.
Tell Kelly to hush. You wouldn't expect to see 180 millimeter plus wild omicas, because they'd have migrated by then. And they're going to be a smolt. You rarely see wild smolts over 180, 200 millimeters. Sometimes you do, but... So there's kind of a... It's hard to say that there weren't a lot there just before the steelhead release, because they would have left as smolts. Am I thinking right on that? I think so. The only ones that would be left would be the one-year-old, maybe a few two-year-old small wild omicus that hadn't migrated yet, because they'll migrate a year or two later.
I think that's what Ryan was getting at when he was talking about maybe doing some surveys before the hatcheries to
good idea. That's a good idea.
A couple weeks earlier.
I don't know whether Jeff ever got you to try any of the snorkel-based abundance estimates that he used to be quite the fan of, Ryan?
No, we did not.
I know how frustrating it was, but it was a source of abundance estimates that might work if you're going to get wet.
Well, I was even thinking of using the GoPro for that sort of approach because, you know, a lot of times the fish are out, especially, you know, later in summer in July, they're out where there's more oxygen out in the flowing water and the riffles and the heads of the pools and stuff, and can be really hard to get a good count of them as you drift over them, but using the GoPro, you know, and you can go back to the office and slow it down and watch the video, you get a much better count, so that might be a good approach, having a couple of people tag team it and just video everything, and could even you know, get some sort of a time sync GPS with your video and get you know, spatial abundance.
Right. Yeah, I think the thing that's really lacking is we don't have really good estimates of abundance of either wild or hatchery fish, and in reference, Dave, your earlier comment, do we know what the carrying capacity for Omicus is below Foster? Absolutely not. That's not known. So,
right.
I mean, it's conceivable that that there is no competition occurring because the food is not limiting, and space is not limiting. I mean, that's conceivable. And but you need to know what the actual abundance is. So just even to start. Any cool other, beans, Ryan.
Any other questions?
Yeah, just a couple things. Want to let you know that I received Ryan's final report right before Christmas. I will send that out to everybody today. And then, second, he will be presenting these results again at the science review. So thanks a lot, Ryan. Appreciate it.
Are you?
Yeah, thank you.
Ryan, are you going to be at the Hatchery Wild Symposium?
Yes. Well, oh, sorry.
Tomorrow and Friday?
No, I will not be attending that. Running a little low on funds at this point.
Of course, not paying you enough.
Dave, any parting thoughts before we move on?
I'm good.
Okay. Thanks, Ryan.
So I guess before I get off, should we be continuing the exploration of the potential for this smaller radio tag? I mean, right now I'm sure there's interest elsewhere. We haven't really solicited the idea a whole lot. I'm sure we wouldn't have any trouble finding people interested in a small radio tag the last hundreds of days. But I guess how pressing is this? Do I need to push the engineering team to try or something for this spring, or maybe that's a conversation for another time?
That's a great question. Why don't we talk offline, and I can meet with some folks here internally. I would really like to pursue another year of work. I think funding's an issue right now, but maybe I can extract some money out of somebody. So let's talk about this, or let me talk with some folks offline, you know, at CORE, and then let's you and I chat, and we'll try to do that very soon.
Okay, that sounds good, Dave.
Yeah, thank you.
All right, next item. Cam, you're going to talk about Coast Fork releases and some preliminary Coulda Wire tag data you sent out.
Andy, you want to fire that up?
Yeah.
So, the spreadsheet that Andy's going to put up, the first line says draft preliminary analysis. Do not distribute.
I was afraid of even.
Tom wanted it all splayed across the middle of the page. All right. We got a great survey season this past year, everywhere but in the Coast Fork. We had muddy water when we tried to survey the Coast Fork. So the data I'm presenting here are exclusively coded wire tag recoveries in the Mackenzie system. The background here is that in 2012, roughly equal numbers of fish were released from the Mackenzie hatchery directly into the Mackenzie and from the Mackenzie hatchery into the Coast Fork. And that, those are values on row 3 of the spreadsheet. So in excess of 200,000 fish released at about the same time in those two different locations. We collected coda wire tags from 1961 hatchery fish at Mackenzie Hatchery in 2014, a couple of hundred more from spawning ground surveys, and 90 from creel surveys down below Willamette Falls and out in the ocean.
Is this data on the screen, or we don't see it?
Oh, yeah, put it back on your desktop.
There
it is.
Oh, is it? It's on...
Elbows. How about now, Lance?
Thanks, Lance.
Yeah, got it. Thanks.
So the Coda Wire Tag Lab read about 500 tags from the hatchery releases, and I think all of the tags from Mackenzie Fish from the fishery sampling, and they're working on finishing up the hatchery tags, so they've got another 1,200 to go, and then they're starting on the spawning ground survey tags. So this is just from fishery and hatchery recoveries. In 2014, the row 3 is the raw observed hatchery recoveries. 128 tags were recovered from fish that were released in the Mackenzie, and 18 tags were recovered in the Mackenzie, at the Mackenzie hatchery, from fish that were released in the Coast Fork. So we could stop right there and say that there was at least a positive effect of reprogramming those fish to the Coast Fork. It was a very, very large difference. They didn't all just go back to the Mackenzie. And that, there's statistics there off to the right. However, there was also a big difference in the recoveries in the fisheries. So on row 6, we got 67 tags back from the various fisheries from the Mackenzie release into the Mackenzie, and only 23 back from Coast Fork release. And that's highly significant. So the Coast Fork released fish appeared to have a lower survival to the fishery, which means that they wouldn't have been alive and available to stray. So part of the deficit in hatchery recoveries from the Mackenzie is due to lower survival of the fish released in the Coast Fork. From the perspective of PHAS, that doesn't matter. I mean, our objective was, one of the objectives, was to decrease PHAS in the Mackenzie, and that would have occurred. But from the fishery management objectives, that is relevant. They didn't survive, and we don't know why. And because they didn't survive, it was necessary to try to figure out what effect that would have had on the recoveries in the Mackenzie in case it was just low survival of Coast Fork releases that meant we got low recoveries in the Mackenzie hatchery. And that's not the case. If you go down, scroll down. In row 9 there, sorry, go up one. In row 8, I adjusted the observed hatchery recoveries to account for the lower survival of the Coast Fork released fish. And it went from the raw count of fish we saw at the hatchery was 18. You adjust it up because of about one-third the survival, and it goes to a kind of expected observed of 52 fish. But that is still highly significant. That's a much smaller number than you'd expect in either case. So that part of it worked. PHAS will have been reduced a lot. The Coast Fork release fish did not contribute to PHAS in the Mackenzie at a rate that is anything like Mackenzie release fish do.
Did you see any of those fish show up at Dexter?
I didn't look. we're getting to work on
the you know, like
right
the, well, no, what I'm saying is they just swam right by.
They could have, but I haven't looked yet.
Okay.
We're just focusing on the...
Well, I understand the desire is to reduce the number. We could do that by eliminating fish or get them to go someplace else,
right.
But...
Well, what we've done now is we're switching it all over the Mackenzie, but over the course of the next few years, we've got to see what these Mackenzie stocked fish do when they come back. That's all. What's missing is the spawning ground survey. EOS is fish on the spawning grounds. So we don't have any data yet from the spawning ground survey recoveries, and that's a risk because, as I said here, if they didn't return to the hatchery because they strayed to the Mackenzie River and spawned out there, then there might still be a PDOS effect that we haven't accounted for yet. So that's what we're waiting on. The graph at the bottom shows everything that's in the data table above, so you can peruse that at your leisure. That first pair of histobars is, I mean, that's the biggest bang for your buck right there. One is really big and one is really small. So. Questions?
Yeah, Cam, so what were the indications of any of the adults coming back to the coast for? Was there any information there?
Yeah, we've got a few reds and I believe a couple of carcasses, but when we surveyed it twice, both came, but especially the first day, it was muddy water and very, very poor survey conditions. That might be the case routinely down in the Coast Fork. I think it's very unlike any of the other spring Chinook streams we survey. Can't expect to get real good visibility routinely in those systems. And it'd be a pretty big investment to do a full-blown survey without additional support crew. We pulled it off two surveys to try to get peak count, and it just didn't work because you can't see the bottom.
Is it still on? Was there any indications of anybody catching any fish in the Coast Fork this year?
Not very many. There were we heard of a few, and we didn't have any monitoring in place, so it was kind of just what you heard through the grapevine.
Will we get that from catch record cards? Can they code the Coast Fork on their salmon steelhead card?
Yes.
So we'll get something in 2 years.
The big deal was that there really wasn't a fishery is generated by the excitement of the anglers, and you really didn't see that. And we may see a bit more of that this year since we will have both 4-year-olds and 5-year-olds coming back. And if a fishery gets going, the word of mouth will increase the use up there, if it's anything worthwhile anyway.
Jeff, in your opinion, is it worthwhile to continue the surveys up there? Can we expect to get decent survey conditions if we invest?
I actually think you can. I think it was a little bit of an anomaly last year. Having the discolored water, normally, you know, you should be able to get a count somewhere toward the end of September, first part of October. That's pretty good.
Okay. Then we'll do it again. We'll try.
You know, I guess the real question is, what are you trying to get out of that? Are you trying to recover tags, or are you trying to get an accurate spawning ground survey? Because from a spawning standpoint, we're really not expecting much production out of that, out of those fish that do spawn up there.
I was hoping to get something to serve as an abundance estimator so we could take our expanded red counts, estimates of pre-spawning mortality, add them together, and that would be the number of fish that entered the fishery or entered the river. Conceivable.
Okay.
Not accounting for harvest. But if we can't get a reasonable peak red count and can't collect carcasses to get at pre-spawning mortality, then it's moot.
And these fish that were moved there recently had how many tags?
Many.
Many.
So all of the fish that were released in 2012 were go to our tag. Okay. And Kurt, if you're still on the phone,
88,000.
Okay. Yeah, 88. Does that 88? That doesn't include the ones that went in the ditch, does it?
No, that's why it's 88.
Okay, yeah. Instead of 100. Okay.
Any other questions for Cam? All right. You want to take a break, or do you want to power through those last few items?
I'm good, or if you can take a break, whatever.
Let's take 5 minutes.
I have the draft disposition table if you want to load it up. You didn't send that.
No, I gave you the model. So yeah. Okay. Did you look that?
Oh, yeah.
Beautiful. Things can change.
I did bring it up.
Did you get color on it?
Color is
good. Are you allowed to?
Color's good.
You're not allowed to do this one.
Oh, I think so.
I won't look.
They'll turn it. Try it.
I can email it to you.
Oh, shoot. Got you're going to touch that, and then you're going to bring it back.
The whole core is going to go down.
Hey, the guys at ISD will know you've done this.
Our people are a little more lenient than their people.
Oh, no.
I've read all those new policies. They say things like,
but they're still
if
watching.
If it's necessary, you can do it.
They will report these things to your supervisor, and we accumulate this data. We save it HR, and then the day that comes, we want to remove you.
I'm living on the edge.
Yeah. It's funny, because if you disguise it as some cameras, it worked up to a recent point. It was so funny. Just try anything randomly.
It's loose, and then it's the one that stated it says draft adult disposition table 116. There's two versions.
Yeah.
Hey, Cam, when you were pit tagging Steelhead going out of South San Diego, how many of those hung out in the raceway? Failed to migrate?
You know, I don't know. That's definitely a Mark and Tom question. Okay.
It wasn't a phenomenal number like these radio tag ones.
No, that's squirrely because, I mean, another way of looking at it, comparing the residuals in the raceway to a radio tag versus not tag, the fish were nearly 20 times as likely to hang up in the raceway if they were radio tagged.
So therefore, they'd be 20 times as likely to hang up in the river. Therefore, that's a problem. I knew that we had like 20% hang up last year.
Yeah,
in 2013, I thought it had improved, and that's I thought Brett was saying that they moved out, but apparently not. And then if you go out in the river and use that to say, well, there's this many residuals hatchery fish based on the numbers you find in the pool.
Mm-hmm.
I'd be interested to know then. Then that forces us to say, well, how many wild fish did you see compared to the hatchery fish? And therefore, if we residualized 40,000 hatchery fish, therefore, there must be a gazillion wild fish out there,
right.
Which means production was a whole lot better than we ever estimated it was. I think there's a way that could push it backwards, but I would hate to try to defend something like that if I got a 20-fold difference.
Radio telemetry, it's when you need it, it's great. Okay? You've got to have it for some things. Good luck.
It's okay in here. You have to step out.
You're not trying to get reception. This is what you do, is you just turn it off in here. It just sucks batteries and tells you.
I'm just green on the building. Yeah.
This is the worst corner of the whole building.
Is it? I think I remember on our
it's
outage
meeting.
It's got
its pluses and minuses, you know.
They can't get
focus,
you. They can't get you.
The pain appears.
What's bad is the classroom over there where they have the RMT ELT meetings.
You can get service in there.
Marginal. Well, yeah. You know, I've been able to get it, but it just sucks power out of the machine. That's, actually, the whole front half of this building is messed up because even out on the front porch, it's not very good.
Your own little tower.
Yeah, I've got one for the property I have on the coast. It's like $100. Plug it in and then you can be anywhere around, not the whole property, but you can be 50, 75 yards away from the house and still get cell reception. So it's $100. It just plugs in.
Yeah, and the receptacle, the boosters,
yeah,
the boosters. Those things are great.
Yeah.
They're like stupid proof, easy.
Huh. For cell, this is cell, not Wi-Fi.
Right, cell. But it only works for Verizon phones if you have a Verizon booster, or AT&T phones if you have an AT&T booster, they don't cross talk.
That's cool. Yeah.
Yeah, that's odd. Because the signals have got different, I guess?
Yeah, I guess. I don't know. I think it's just
probably. Probably have to put some special code and prevent that from every other country in the world. They probably can communicate to each other. They're multilingual once you get out of the U.S.
Yeah. So here's a question about this right here. The simplest comparison you can make for these coated wire tag recoveries is using a contingency. Yeah, you have observed recoveries. You can calculate expected recoveries a whole bunch of different ways. And the one I picked was that there's no effect. That planting the fish in the Ghost Fork had no effect on their final distribution. They'd all come back from McKenzie.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, it's the null hypothesis that the management action had no effect. That's not very palatable because it's so unlikely that that will actually occur, that there would be no effect. But what's an alternative? What kind of use that has more biological biologically sensible foundation, like, and I can't pick it out of the air, I can't say there was a 10% effect, because it's the same thing, it's just arbitrary, but, and I can't come up with one.
I think it's going to be difficult, because ultimately, from an ESA perspective, we want to make sure that fish aren't straying and PHAS isn't going to increase.
That's kind of what I was trying to go at, is there a sufficient decrease in PHAS or something.
Yeah, that's the only thing I can think
of. So what is sufficient? It gets back to this goals dialogue we've been having right now. There aren't goals set up like that. There should be, but...
I mean, the only thing I can think of are the criteria in the recovery plan or in the buyout. As kind of what you're inching towards.
Right. So, but I'd have to be able to say, okay, what we want this management action to do, this particular one of 10 things we're doing, we want that to have a particular effect size. What is that effect size?
Gotcha.
And I can't come up with it, so I'm stuck with this. And luckily it's fine, because it's such a huge difference. But it didn't have to be. It could have been pretty closer, and then I'd be stuck saying, okay, I was able to detect a significant difference, but only because the expected values were based on unrealistic expectation. So,
good luck.
I'd rather wait for the rest of the data, though, because
it's
okay with that.
It's
going
to change.
I know it's going to change. So of course it's going to change.
Let's get started. All right, we're back. Everyone on the phone back? Are we still there?
Yep, I'm here.
Okay. All right, so the next item, we talked about this at the last meeting, and I'll cross out surplus if you have a new term for these extra fish, which are...
Unsanctioned.
And we talked about we have more fish on site at McKenzie than we know what to do with.
No.
Well, barring the HGMP, or do you have news from that?
No, but one of the outcomes is that the judge will say, yeah, we are allowed to go to the 605,000. So we won't know that until sometime in March. But that's okay because we can release. But isn't that on the agenda for a later discussion? We're going to talk about
Well, we can skip it if you want.
No, I don't want to skip it.
I mean...
Okay. Okay.
My thought was it would be a fairly quick discussion, but maybe it won't be.
I think it should be fast. Yeah. This is where we are right now. I contacted the district down in Clackamas office to see if they're interested in or know anything about net pens down in Clackamas Cove. Todd Alsbury is interested, and... he's going to go look to see if the net pens are available. Kurt Kremers, I talked to Kurt about the possibility of late net pen acclimation at the mouth of the Columbia, because they don't have room to accept the fish now. And this all started when we thought we might have to get rid of some fish, and right now, that's not an issue right now. Right now we're just kind of hanging on. But according to Kurt, that's what we've done in the past. We can, after they've released some of their fish, that frees up space in April for us to transfer fish down there. So we can see if we'll do that. And then, based on the final outcome from this Clearwater tag analysis, when we get the spawning ground surveys, another option is a Coast Fork release. I'm sure there are others. Kill all the fish. But those are the three that Andy and I really kind of talked about when we got together. Coast Fork, which is a good idea if it works out based on this year's 2014's Clearwater tag analysis, which we'll have pretty soon. Clackamas Cove, if acclimation can occur, the net pens are available, and we can figure out how to get the fish fed. And the third option of mouth of the Columbia release is still viable if we can hold on to the fish until April. So I guess we're just kind of waiting for, in large part, what the Jeff says.
So for those sites, we're ready to go if we need to?
That's what Todd is checking on right now for the Clackamas Cove. We need the net pens.
Okay. And so some feedback on the Clackamas Cove deal. So we kind of been there, done that, and we moved away from it years and years ago because there was a lot of issues on strain and the fishery piece of it wasn't that great. So that, I don't know how feasible that's going to be from our standpoint in doing that.
Hold on, I thought I went through Kirk Schroeder's paper on that, report on the, and my recollection was that the Clackamas Cove acclimated and Clackamas Cove direct release actually did, those fish did get intercepted in the lower river fishery at a higher rate. It was Multnomah channel releases that didn't increase harvest, and something else across from a park in the main lower Willamette. I'll go back and look at it again, but have you seen Kirk's write-up on all that?
Well, it's been many, many years now. I guess the concern that you want to look at is the McKenzie fish going up the Clackamas. So that's kind of what killed it years and years ago, was we wanted this population by population management, and putting McKenzie fish into the lower Clackamas is a concern.
So that would be, I thought you meant straying back to the McKenzie, which will be lower than if we put them in the McKenzie. Okay.
Yeah, so go back and look at that data. I mean, there were McKenzie fish that went up the Clackamas, which is kind of contrary to what we want to do basin-wide. So that's the main concern that I have.
Okay. Well, that happened for how many years? Since the early to mid-90s, certainly about through about 2005,
years.
I think.
I think 2004 was the data, so 10 years or so.
Yeah. Okay. I'll go back and review the paper, but those are the three options that we were looking at, and all of them have shortcomings. But
okay. So for the net pen idea in the Columbia, I'm just wondering if that's something we'll have to modify the cooperative agreement, because in the cooperative agreement it says Willamette Basin. I don't know how.
I don't know either. See, that doesn't happen here.
I know.
That does not happen here.
I know.
Yeah, that doesn't sit well with me either. These fish should be contributing to a Willamette fishery, not a Columbia fishery, except they overlap. Like I said, I'm looking for places to put the fish.
No, I understand.
Those are the three options.
I'm just thinking of things that might hinder us.
Hey, Lance, this is Andy. So do you have enough concerns with the mouth of the Clackamas releases to take that option off the table?
Well, go back and look at we need to go back and look at the data, but yeah, I mean, that's kind of contrary to the direction that we've been managing for these stocks for, you know, ever since ESA came online. And, you know, technically that's in the lower Clackamas River. It's not a good thing. So, you know, those other options are definitely better fit than Clackamas. I mean, Clackamas fish is one of our core wild populations, and, you know, we don't want McKenzie fish going up the Clackamas.
But would the McKenzie fish get up into the wild fish zone? Because they wouldn't they be picked off at the dam if they tried? How's that work? I don't know much about the Plaquemines, but Luke does. I can ask him.
Yeah, I guess that's possible. I don't know. It's definitely, like you say, Andy, on the bottom of the list of options from my standpoint. I mean, we've kind of already been there, done that on the Clackamas Cove. We've changed that management. So it seems like a higher priority or a better option would be, you know, Coast Fork and some of those other things, Nep Ends.
Okay, thanks.
Anybody else thought about this in terms of where we might put these fish, John?
Long Tom.
Hey guys, this is Kurt again. I missed that whole conversation. Was there any resolution?
Not really. We came up with a list
the
of sites.
Clackamas
Cove, is that where these are at? Was listed, but doesn't sound like it's very desirable from an ESA perspective. The Coast Fork again, and then Nep Ends on the Columbia as potential.
Okay.
But nothing has been kind of determined at this point. We're going to kind of wait and see what happens.
So I spoke for you, Kurt, because of our conversation. You think it is feasible to get a late transport of fish to the Nep Ends if it happens in, like, April?
Yeah, I do. Talking with Alan down there.
I've left the conference.
The fish that we took down there late last year, we just had one pond of fish. I went in the first week of April. He said he had lots of room at that time, normally that time of year. So I'm just guessing that that would be the same thing that would be available this year.
Okay. So it's on the table.
All right. Any other thoughts from the group before we move on?
So for next month, will you have an answer on the Clackamas Cove next month, whether it's available or not?
Yeah. I should have all this, too.
Yeah, okay.
This happens fast now that they've got the fire under them.
So we'll kind of have all the info we need for the different options, and then it's just kind of waiting on what the judge says from there.
Right.
Okay.
All right. Next item, adult fish disposition. Want to get that either Bernadette's spreadsheet or a spreadsheet up?
So ODFW met internally last week and reviewed last year's disposition table and made some updates. And so that's what Andy's got up on the screen here. There's some additional notes and things. I guess probably the biggest changes were the addition of some of the outplanting sites that weren't on there before, like Corn Creek, and later on a few more. But Cam's probably a better person to lead this discussion.
Okay.
No pressure.
That's fine. So we're working downstream about the North Sandy Am, Chinook. I think we left the target numbers for the North Sandy Am above Detroit the same. I think we changed those. I very much want to try again planting just 50 pairs of fish in Horn Creek with a weir in place. Our observations were that we did not have a lot of red superimposition. It looked like a comfortable number of reds to have in that stream rather than having the highest red density of anywhere in the Willamette Basin on the hatchery grounds. That looked like a better way of doing it. What we haven't done yet is to look to see whether there's a real detectable increase in the distribution of the fish that were precluded from entering Horn Creek voluntarily, which I think we can do. Just need to figure out how to do the math.
Are we talking about moving that weir farther down Horn Creek as well? Is that
going to
happen this year?
We're going to try. Every time we have conversations with you guys, I would like to broach the idea of getting better weirs in the North Sandy Am. Better weirs in Marion Creek, better weirs in Horn Creek. Although Horn Creek, the upstream weir is pretty good. Write that down. We need better weirs. Greg was able to get a wonderful agreement with the resort owners, and we think that we can increase the number of fish that are planted in the Brighton Bush. That appeared to work. This past year we didn't get that many in, but we got lots of reds there, which is really nice. First time in a long time that we had lots of spawn in the Brighton Bush. Spring Chinook and the North Sandy Am above Minto Dam, all right now it's all unclipped fish put up there. There are no fish program for the Little North Fork Sandy M River now. I don't know what that next line is.
Not putting any.
Oh, not releasing any
below Minto.
Unclipped fish below Minto. They get there all by themselves, dropping downstream. Brood stock size is 450 pairs. Whatever's left, put a food share. For steelhead, all steelhead go above Minto Dam. Who's your steelhead? Is there a deep sigh?
Sorry, that was me.
Where would you like to see him go?
For another reason.
Oh, different reason? Okay.
So what I see is the number for spring chinook going above Minto being the same as last year, right?
Right.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's a target number there, but it's pretty much all...
Whatever comes back. Since we're not taking any wild fish into broodstock, we're not outplanting any unclipped fish above Detroit, they have to go somewhere. And what we did last year.
So we're hoping that we'll put them above and that they'll move back down.
Fall back down.
And those that spawn up there that may survive will survive.
To make up 80 reds last year. Peak red count was 80 fish, so that was a tenth of the number of fish we put up.
Okay.
80 reds.
Hey, Cam, did you, in your surveys down below Minto, did you see... did you see evidence of fallback? Because all fish are all Floyd tagged, right?
All fish were pit tagged and Floyd tagged. And yes, we saw fish that fell back. We know they were still alive because they attempted to reascend. 12%. And we, unfortunately, just because we collect a carcass of a spawned fish below Minto, we don't know where it spawned. All we know is we collected the carcass there.
So, Cam, you said there was 80 reds above Minto?
Yeah, it's awesome. We got two surveys near peak spawn timing this year, and everybody survived.
80 reds, and there were, what, almost 600 spring chinook put up there?
Well, I think it was nearly 800.
Oh, 800, I'm sorry. And 80 reds is awesome?
That spawning did occur, and we didn't kill any surveyors.
Oh, I see. All right.
That's awesome.
Yeah, the fish-to-red ratio still sucks.
Yes.
But if you had, I mean, you know at least 12% fell back and tried to reascend, you probably have a lot more fallback than
you
that.
Had to have had a bunch more fallback.
So gave them a car, they drive above Detroit.
So, did you guys give any thought to putting fish above the project at all in mm-hmm. your discussions?
So I spoke to Kathleen O'Malley, and her first round of pedigree assignments for Minto unclipped fish will be available in May. May, with luck, maybe that will be enough time to make some decisions on what to do, depending on what the outcome is. What is the outcome going to be? If it's 20% of the unclipped fish that we collect DNA from at Minto, pedigree back to fish we outplanted above Detroit, I don't think we want to put all the unclipped fish above Detroit. I don't think so. But if it's 80%, what do we want to do? Or if it's 70% like it is at Foster? And those are policy decisions. But I can say the range is going to be from 0 to 100%. Somewhere in there. Anyway. It's a very exciting time. I mean, we should have the data before we need to make the decision, which is a little unusual. No changes with the summer steelhead? Any objections to the recycle? Recycle one time, discontinue on August 1st.
That was 1,300 we recycled this year.
Is that doable logistically? Do you think it works? Does it contribute to the fishery?
Yeah, it's a lower number than historical runs before temperature ops, but very doable.
Okay.
And we just, like you said, recycled once, and if they came back with a Floyd tag, then they were euthanized and went to food share.
And then we had to deal with lamprey just in case another shows up. We got one.
Okay.
Or
We got one at Foster and one at Minto. So
we got one at Minto.
So we're just trying to figure out if those fish are going to have any tags that we want to make sure to get hands on. So if he could pass them upstream here without handling them, if we don't need to look at the tags, assuming they came down.
It was one fish.
Yeah.
Is Fish and Wildlife Service on board with that?
I think they were last year. There was some discussion going around as to whether we wanted to hold if we only got one until more arrived, but no more never arrived, so we didn't really have to.
Yeah, we can check with them.
Get to that point, but you know, we can circle back and I'll do that.
It'd be nice to be at this meeting. Yes.
Hey, Cam, on the spreadsheet or someone, can you make a note that the genetics information is supposed to be available in May? With a line maybe for Spring Chinook above Minto.
Got it.
Put that in the comment section.
Lance, do you have any just gut feeling for what direction the NOAA and NIFS would like to go if the proportion of assigned fish is, say, 70 or 80%?
Well, if it's that high, yeah, definitely go for it. But that'll be something we'll have to coordinate, you know, with Stephanie's folks and such. But
oh, absolutely. But
I mean, we want to do that, but we want information first. It'll probably be like 50-50.
Yeah. Okay, so same. All unclipped fish above Foster Dam. We'll be increasing the number of fish we're taking for brood because of program changes. Remaining clipped fish have a variety of dispositions that are in place already.
What are the program changes?
So if you yeah, so they're taking some fish for the safe program.
Oh,
Have we done pedigree? I've been out of the Harmony loop. Have we done pedigree work here?
Yeah, Melissa Evans presented on it last Science Review, and I think she had 2 years worth of data. At that point, it was in the order of 70 to 80% of the unclipped fish going up there.
Okay.
So. Steelhead, we continue to DNA sample and pit tag those fish, but that kind of fell apart last year. The pit tag antenna on Foster Dam was non-functional for such a long time, and we weren't able to get useful.
A participant has left the conference.
Useful information about kelting or anything from the pit tag detections. I'm assuming it's working now. I think it is.
Who operates that?
Goodbye. No.
The big flat plate?
The flat plate. Is that somebody out of the Dow's office?
I thought took the lead on that. I don't know who operates it.
Like Fenton pays the bills, but I don't know who operates it.
So I guess what can we do to make sure it is operating?
Fred.
I thought it was Fred. Operating that.
No, yeah. Because he was involved at the beginning, but he wasn't
that's,
involved.
Okay. That's our last contact, was going to the preliminary training with his crew.
It's a minor thing. The Corps donated the tags. We know we want to get DNA samples because I can't believe at some point we're not going to be wanting to do pedigree assignments where we can do adult to adult the same models we have for Chinook. We'll translate it to steelhead. We have, so far now, 2 complete years with 100% DNA sampling of steelhead over Foster. And in 2 years, their offspring can start coming back. So we'll continue to do that. The same summer steelhead recycling program as last year, a little more complicated than what was going on in North San Diego. But
what's the rationale for being different in the north and south?
To accommodate the fishery down there. Very, 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 very popular fishery. It's a good fishery. I caught my first summer steelhead there in my life, and if I can catch it. very good fishing.
That's a real high pressure place. Yeah.
It's in Sunset Magazine. Oh, okay.
It is.
there are people fishing that
river as opposed to one or two. It looks like you're going down a parade down the river.
Mm-hmm.
And we used to recycle those things until they get tired. I mean, this is a radical change to the fishing public. Was it 2 years ago we started this, wasn't it? Was it last year they were screaming at me?
Two years ago
they started screaming. I mean, they were just, you know, it was going to be rebellion. Then tended to work pretty good the last couple of years. I mean, it's a reasonable substitute for what we had been doing. So
might increase the back on the field.
Yeah, I think that.
Yeah.
Fin share, for want of something else to do, we're releasing resident fish above Foster Dam. I don't think we've ever got a lamprey. Certainly didn't get one last year.
Mm-hmm.
I know.
Didn't they get one when they cleaned the ladder out?
Oh, yeah, when they emptied the ladder.
They got a lamprey.
Yeah, we got a lamprey.
And he didn't kill us.
Well, the thing is that if he took that one lamprey upstream, it's the only lamprey up there.
Yeah.
You can send out a special signal.
Yeah. Attract others.
Mm-hmm. Maybe there's one up there already waiting.
But how did it get up? Okay.
call it climb the dam.
Yeah.
Could happen.
They can do that.
All right. Mackenzie, our program is based on the 605,000 release program. We are not allowed to put any wild fish in the brood, and I think the read is that even if we get a letter of sufficiency, it still isn't an approved HGMP, so it seems unlikely to occur in 2015. So this will be the third year in a row, nearly a full generation of Chinook where integration has not occurred. All unclipped fish will be passed above Lieber.
So Jeff, did you want to talk about the cougar out planning? Ziller?
What about them? In terms of what we're going to do?
Yeah.
We were thinking it would be pretty similar to last year. Let me grab something real quick.
Hey, Wally, grabbing something real quick. I've got a question. The last year and this year, it's proposed to be what we've been operating under, the outplanting of hatchery fish above cougar to be limited to 400 females and 200 males, and to augment the hatchery, the wild fish. But a spreadsheet I was sent by Cameron shows that last year we actually outplanted 563 hatchery fish. I'm wondering why we did that.
Those are, I believe, Taylor's numbers included in your spreadsheet, right?
Right, so when we add in, I think the hatchery overshot by a small amount, and then we added in the portion of the clip fish you guys outplanted from cougar, because it was very clear at that point.
Very poor.
We were going to need to put hatchery fish up there. So we ended up targeting the 2-to-1 ratio and nailing that, but there was something like 90 extra fish that went out.
It was like 79. We were looking at it yesterday.
Yeah.
And definitely biased towards females.
Okay. What I'm looking at is there was 155 unclipped and 563 clipped fish outplanted.
Sounds about right.
Who is that?
How does that jive with the 400, 200? I guess I'm not.
That's a minimum. Target minimum escapement.
Yeah.
Oh, minimum. So we can actually put whatever we want up there then?
Well, yeah, we can. Technically, we can.
I thought it was a target.
It is a kind of a target. But technically, we can put up more if we think that there's a need. We're probably going to stick to that.
And we're close to it.
Yeah. That's where I think we should be sticking to it, unless somebody's got a strong argument to get a bunch more fish up there.
I don't think so.
Yeah, the intent is to have that minimum 400 females, but, I mean, we don't want to go way overboard with hatchery supplementation where we, you know, skew out the wilds to 10%. I mean, that's contrary to what we're trying to do, so we need to be mindful of the total number of hatchery fish that go above cougar that's above the 400.
Right. So
I think we were. One of the things that we have been shooting for in the past is, you know, a bigger number, mainly for bull trout food up there, and from my standpoint anyway. And there's other things in play here, so I don't until we get a downstream migrant plan for Cougar Reservoir, we're basically throwing fish away that we put up there.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. When it's going to become really important is when we start getting 200, 300, 400 unmarked females going above there. We don't want to add in a whole bunch more of hatchery supplementation. I mean, now when you're talking 100, 150 females, if that, not as big of a deal. But when we get hundreds of wild females going above there, then we want to be real close to the threshold for hatchery supplementation.
Yeah, I think everybody understands that. So did you want me to go over what we were thinking about for this year?
Yeah.
So what we're looking at is still, you know, shooting for those same targets, but one of the things that we're not sure about is when to be putting help me out, Cam.
What's the date that we're going to switch from passing fish that are unclipped and screening them by transporting them downstream?
Is September 1st, Dave?
Yeah.
Okay.
So we have quite a number of them that we can't, you know, target back to above Cougar Dam, and we want to make sure that we aren't passing fish that have traditionally spawned in the main stem McKenzie or South Fork, or originally spawned in the South Fork McKenzie or the main stem McKenzie up above the dam because of the hit that they're going to take on survival. So we're thinking about coming up with a better plan on when to start the two and you're up program. And we don't have a good date for that yet. And what we were going to look at are a number of different things. One, the spawning grounds counts on the South Fork to see what kind of changes we've seen in spawning distribution and numbers over the past few years. We're also going to look at the 2013 and 2014 unassigned fish that we're going to get information from Mark Johnson on. And then we'll rewrite the disposition table to pick out whatever date looks like it's the best one for minimizing the number of unassigned fish that go above Cougar Dam. So that's going to take a little work. Cam and the district are going to try and come up with that date.
What's the general timeline on that in terms of when you think?
Probably sometime in February or March.
I'm starting after the science review, Ernest, but okay. I start before the science review.
So you'll put together something similar to what Bernadette, or somebody will put something together similar to what we did last year.
Right.
We'll circulate it to the group. And,
yeah.
So Jeff, are you thinking the September 1st date doesn't work well or needs to be tweaked or what?
Yes. Yeah, there's just too many unassigned that are going up earlier than that.
Is it about the same ratio as after September 1?
Oh, no. But in terms of total numbers, it's a significant number of fish. I mean, you're talking 40, 50 fish that are unassigned that are going up above Cougar Dam, and we're, you know, we're being sued on 20 fish going into McKenzie Hatchery. So it's a significant number.
But what about the unassigned after September 1st?
They're still part of that regular program. We're going to just start the two and you're up program earlier. So we'll be trucking fish downstream at an earlier date and then continuing that trucking downstream all the way through to the end of the season.
Okay. Well, maybe I'm not up to date on the latest information because it seemed like it was working fairly well because you're never going to be completely perfect.
We know that.
Any thoughts on what date or how much sooner you're thinking? Or do we not know?
We're gonna work through the data and see what it tells us.
Okay.
Okay, still got trail bridge on the table, 60 pairs, as in the past couple of years. Placeholder for Mohawk of 50 pairs if they're available. These are all in line with the Shimby.
Right.
Yes. Stream enrichment, sales. Summer steelhead is non-issue, it's not an ESU. Resident fish and lamprey are back on the river. $2,500 fish for broodstock collection in the Middle Fork Willamette. If fish are available, there will be some tribal. Excuse me. seemed to go really well this past year in terms of outplanting. The Corps took care of the North Fork, Middle Fork outplants and seemed to be comfortable with the logistics there.
Yeah,
so we're not proposing any change there.
Yeah, we're veterans now.
Another plan above Hills Creek, we can keep it about the same as last year, but we have some significantly increased pre-spawning mortality of those fish, so I want to have some discussions with how that's done, because there's, I mean, it's not like we're expecting any natural production out of above Hills Creek, but as I understand it, that's one place that we're going to be attempting a head of reservoir collection and transport of juvenile fish. Is that funded? Anybody know anything about that? I think that's going forward.
I know.
If we're going to try that, we need to have juvenile production, so I want to get higher survival of the fish that are outplanted above there. So it's not just nutrient enhancement, it's actual juvenile production. Uh, 50 pairs in Little Fall Creek. That was the stellar producer below Dexter this past year. Very important to get outplanting in Little Fall Creek because 24 of the 25 total reds counted in our peak red count were in Little Fall Creek. One red below Dexter. One.
What kind of temperatures do you see in Little Fall Creek?
It's a little warmer, but it's better than Dexter. Top of the
fish. Okay.
Hold it. Up.
Can you go back up again?
Unclipped
fish.
Right now, the unclipped fish that come into Dexter because of, again, the HGMP, have to be returned to the river. Okay, they all died. So they came back up into the hatchery multiple times. There was one instance of a unclipped fish returning to Dexter. I believe it was six different times. It gets handled every time. They don't like it. They don't, you know, we want to do something different than that. When we have an HGMP, it's extremely likely that we can dramatically improve the survival of unclipped fish in the Middle Fork Willamette, because right now it's at zero. So.
They're just screaming, help me, help me.
Really, I mean, seriously, that's, we've got to get those HGMPs off the table,
yeah.
Approved, so we can do, and this is just one place where we really got to do something sensible with these fish. Because, you know, it might only be half of them that are genuinely naturally produced fish, but we're killing all of them.
And the plan is still to put them below?
There's no other place to put them.
What did you want to ask about?
Oh, yeah, I forgot about that. Lance? No, I'm
sorry. It's written.
Didn't read it.
What's that? Missed it.
When we're waiting for approval for the of the HGMPs, in the interim, since we did appear to have production in Little Fall Creek, would an outplant of unclipped fish into Little Fall Creek count as return to the river?
Return to the river.
Right now we're obligated to...
Are they going to be naturally spawning fish if they survive?
Yeah.
So rather
than... What's the designation return to the river? What? I'm not following it.
Because we can't take them into broodstock or outplant unclipped fish anywhere. We don't have an approved HGMP. We have to return them to the river. We don't have a take
authorization. Oh, yeah, okay, I see what you're saying. Well, I don't know. I kind of raised my eyebrow on, you know, the Little Fall Creek, but like we do everywhere else, we want to put these fish in the best possible scenario that where they're going to produce something, and if that's it, then okay. But let's just make sure that everybody's comfortable if that is the best case scenario. Given all of the issues that we have here, particularly. And you guys have a way better sense of that than I do. There's not much habitat in Little Fall Creek, is there?
There's more than below Dexter.
So what was the red count in the Middle Fork below Dexter this last season?
Total peak red count was 25 reds. 24 of them.
25 reds?
Yeah. 24 of them were in Little Fall Creek.
24 of the 25?
Yeah.
One red below Dexter?
Yeah.
How could that be?
There weren't very many fish there. So the extraction of fish for outplanting and all other uses pulled most of the hatchery fish out of there. All of the wild fish, unclipped fish, would keep coming back into Dexter, trying to ascend over and over again. There's quite a bit of stress involved with just capturing those fish, sorting them, and getting them back in the river. If you do that multiple times, their likelihood of survival plummets.
We saw tons of them getting caught, too, by anglers mm-hmm. when we were working fish to outplant to the North Fork, Middle Fork.
It's brutal.
Because they have big yellow Floyd tags on them. You can just see them floating down there, and the anglers are snagging them and releasing them.
Releasing them?
Well, they have to release them.
Yeah. Marshall's in the bushes.
No, if you get him OSP's upstream, they can go downstream and catch him. There's only one guy, so... Yeah, it's a pretty sporting operation down there.
Catching them is the wrong term, really.
Yeah. I mean. Yeah, it's so...
This is something new. Is everybody comfortable with this, of putting the unmarked fish in Little Fall Creek, or what?
We're just broaching it here. I mean, it was last week.
Yeah, I'm just wondering what other people think.
I don't really know what other options we have.
The Watershed Council is working on restoration up there.
Yeah,
it goes hand in hand with a lot of cool things. The old splash dam sites really has a lot of gravel.
The logistics of it might be kind of challenging.
Yeah, really stash them somewhere.
The fish
where do we stash them?
Well, that was the issue that came up when we talked about it. Was you'd have to have a truck just for that.
Yeah.
Well, it doesn't have to be a big truck.
Oh yeah, we have a 300-gallon. We have a little 300-gallon trailer.
Uh-huh.
It's not very far.
Seems like a decent option.
What was the total number of unmarked fish back to Dexter last year? I can't remember.
I can't either. I don't want to make a guess. It wasn't large. I mean, it was 100 or something like that.
Any other thoughts on disposition?
Well, I guess I would like to have some kind of... direction anyway on the Little Fall Creek versus the Middle Fork Willamette release of those fish. And, you know, basically we only have three options. One would be Little Fall Creek, one would be the Middle Fork Willamette, the other one would be Fall Creek above the dam. So they all pose many issues in terms of how you're going to get individual fish.
Mm-hmm.
Up Fall Creek or up Little Fall Creek, since they don't come in all at once.
this something we want to talk about next month?
It's something that we would need to gear up for if we were going to do it. And so whether we put that effort into gearing up for it, it'd be good to know earlier than later if that's something that we have to be thinking about.
Well, the above Fall Creek, given that a lot of the Dexter fish are unmarked hatchery fish, we wouldn't want to change management above Fall Creek Dam on that. So I would put that definitely at the bottom of the list.
And we know from Cam stuff that pretty much 100% of them died in the Middle Fork Willamette. That kind of leaves just one option that seems viable.
So you think you could handle the logistics of that?
It would depend on our other loaded other facilities and, again, how often these fish were being handled, if we were ready to drop everything and come over. Or,
I mean, we were typically, yeah, I guess. It,
yeah. I mean, if we were there every time.
Multiple times, yeah.
Willamette was working, and then we're there every time we did our North Fork stuff with an extra body to be the, or two. To
run. We could handle it, I think, on the days that
we could do something.
Working fish for the North Fork, Middle Fork out plants. I mean, we could have some of there with our little lip tank, but.
And we'd have to get all trained up on going on to Weyerhaeuser land and all that.
It would be better if we could just get the existing sampling crew, mine crew, to do that with a 1-ton and a 300-gallon tank in the back.
Yeah. And you have the capacity for that?
Yeah, I guess. I mean, it has to happen. So that would be...
Jeff, didn't you mention the potential for, like, Watershed Council help?
Yeah, I think there is. We certainly have a lot of volunteers in the area, and if... we actually have some other things going on too that might have something to do with Summer Steelhead up there in terms of volunteers, but that's a possibility.
So it sounds like it's the best option we have right now. Any thoughts, Lance? Or do we need to...
Maybe the thing to do is it sounds like it's potentially a viable option. I'd kind of like everybody to kind of mull it over, and then maybe we can revisit it the next time and make a final decision or something on whether to move forward.
Okay, I'll put it on the agenda for next month.
Okay. Thanks.
All right. Any last questions about fish disposition? All right.
Yeah, I got a follow-up going back to the above Detroit, North St. Am, outplanting of wilds, unmarked. One of the issues that we've had years ago was the Forest Service, as a land manager up there, wants to be apprised of what the plans are for putting wild Chinook up there. So given that the genetics information is going to be available in May, we should start thinking about informing them of what the potential possibilities are. They'll want to know that. So maybe, I don't know who up there is dealing with the Forest Service bios, that maybe talk to them a little bit about this as a possibility.
Greg is coordinating very closely with Darren Neff. So, yeah, he knows what's going on. Greg member.
Just in the FF?
Yes.
Okay, who's the Forest Service bio up there nowadays?
Darren Neff. Greg, he's still on the phone? No.
Okay, good.
All right, moving on to the next item. adult fish release sites, which I don't know if you can't recall if we talked about this last month or the month before. But then you want to kind of tell us kind of where we're at and what our thoughts are in terms of what we think we need to do and get you guys' feedback also.
Yeah, so over the past couple years, we've installed these adult fish release sites throughout the basin and tried to kind of scatter them out to have a couple options for higher in the river system and a little bit lower in the river system, and put them in places where we had gaps before and places where we couldn't release fish previously. And so we've got a number of different sites, some of which are totally functional and they're being used right now, some of which would be functional, but between the time that they were identified and the time that construction was complete, the river conditions have changed, and so what was a pool is no longer a pool. And either there's logs in the way or fast-moving water or whatever. And then there's other sites that aren't usable just because the way that they were designed or the way that they were constructed is too steep. It's really bad for fish to put them in the river in that way. And so I've talked about this with a couple of different folks, and it looks like in most places we have sites that are usable and give us good coverage throughout the basin. The one hole that we have is in the North Santiam itself. We have a couple of potential sites in the Brighton Bush, and the one that Greg's been using that's at the Hot Springs is really, really good. That's right below the north and the middle fork of the Brighton Bush. But the North Santiam itself, the main stem, is where we have one site called Cooper's Ridge. And that's one of the sites that's, it's just unusable. The angle is way too steep and fish come flying out of there and skipping across the top of the water. And so we met with the project manager and with some of the folks that were originally involved with the design of those release sites just a couple days ago and kind of approached the idea of revisiting the North Santiam and either changing that Cooper's Ridge site or scrapping it and using the materials and putting it in a new location that actually will be usable. Because I think technically we probably meet the letter of the law as far as that RPA goes in installing 4 to 6 sites at the basin, but that's the one hole that we have is in the North Santiam. So we look at more of the spirit of what was intended with that RPA. We're not really meeting it in the North Santiam. It's that one hole that we have left to cover. So that's kind of what we're looking at. And so they would like to kind of reconvene a small group of folks to go back out, look at Cooper's Ridge, see if there is anything that we could possibly do to change it or redesign it. And if not, then find a new location and start moving forward with either reusing some of those Cooper's Ridge pieces or just building it from scratch. So that's kind of where we're at with that. Any questions or comments?
What about South Fork? Homestead is another site that was shallow after that, whatever the thing was installed.
Yeah.
It was right in the gravel.
Mm-hmm.
So that is not a legitimate site.
Yeah.
That is, there is not an upper release site that either the Corps or ODFW will use. It improves site, although they are releasing from the hatchery.
Release about the bridge,
Frizzell. That's right.
Well, they also go and release just above where that homestead site is.
Off the 430 bridge.
Yeah, 430. Yeah. I don't know what the number is, but I know exactly where it is. So it's they've been very close to where homestead is. Homestead was low water when they tested it last spring before the water dropped, and
right.
Anticipation was there was going to be no water. But I don't know that. I don't know. I'm not sure exactly what the search has been up there. I think there were some problems with the Forest Service in wanting to keep sites in particular locations.
In the South Fork McKinley?
Yeah, yeah.
Maybe. I don't know. I haven't been involved with any discussions with the Forest Service up there. Do you guys? No,
really.
See, that was an old campground. Mm-hmm. And that's, for
it
some reason.
Down.
Yeah, and they used that. I think there was some desire in a lot of these cases to be able to restrict public access to the release tubes. And so they wanted some place where they could provide security, and that drove some of the decisions.
There isn't a existing upper river, upper South right. Fork McKenzie release location. From the Corps' perspective, who are mostly transporting unclipped, theoretically wild fish, I don't think that's an issue. They'll go find home. But from the perspective of outplanting hatchery fish, we're not getting them into a good release location. I don't know what happens to them. They fall back into the reservoir. I know some of them will spawn where you plant them. But.
So maybe that's another hole that we have, and we should look at adding another site up there.
Mm-hmm.
Is that what I'm hearing?
Yeah. I don't think there was any. No, nobody went forward and resolved the problem. We just kept planting them off that bridge.
Right.
Somebody mentioned something about the wild and scenic river, or something.
That's like always been an issue. That's with the Forest Service. I mean, dictating everything. Yeah, seems to be the big gorilla.
Anyway, so yeah, the two holes, Cooper's Ridge. I thought that we talked about just changing Cooper's Ridge so that it had a much longer side hill approach instead of a slide to life straight down the hill at one of the meetings where we were discussing the same issue.
I think we talked about it, and there was potentially another area near that site where it looked like you could put a pipe down and the slope was a lot less, but that's as far as we got in terms of really exploring the possibility.
Okay.
So that's just another thing to keep on our minds when we reconvene in terms of filling these gaps that we have.
Were there any other gaps? I don't think so. There's the Ashton site.
The Gordon Road site on the South Saint Ambrose site needed different flexible hose. So
the release site's good.
Yeah.
It's just the physical requirements of hooking the thing up to the truck, wasn't it?
It's three people.
18.
Yeah, they can work around that. It actually is a really nice site now.
Yeah, I talked to him. He said he's using it. And no problems. So hopefully
that is really fortunate it got vandalized.
Okay. So I'll add Upper Southport McKenzie to that list of potential new sites and then move forward with that.
So, and on the Brine Bush, I mean, I think the site Greg is using is working fine, but the Gage site, the USGS site.
That one sucks, too.
Yeah, that's kind of, it's too steep. But.
Way too steep. And it's also super close to the reservoir. There's actually, like, almost reservoir influence all the way up there. So that's one I think we'll keep just in case of emergencies as an extreme option, but it's not going to be used in regular rotation.
We have a 5-year agreement for the so far for the resort.
Handshake. Yeah, it's more like that. Agreement.
Peace pipe.
It's good.
Peace
pipe. Yeah.
Any other thoughts or questions about these release sites? So Andy, you'll.
Mm-hmm. I'll probably solicit some of the folks in this group to be a part of that site visit and identifying new areas.
Kirk Kremers has for 10 years been traipsing around the upper watershed looking for these release sites. It's been a long time coming.
Yep.
So he might go just off the cuff.
Mm-hmm.
Totally. All right, well, that was our last item, unless anyone has any other parting thoughts. How about folks on the phone? Any last questions or comments?
Hey, Dave, if you're still on, do you want to spend a minute or two talking about the hatchery supplementation threshold that we put in the HGMP for South Saint Am Chinook?
Yeah, certainly can. I was planning on talking to you this afternoon about it. Since I don't think anybody on the phone knows what we're talking about, but go ahead.
So as we continue to work through the Chinook HGMPs, one of the things that we wanted to see was a threshold for hatchery supplementation above the dams where we're putting wild fish. So we have the cougar one already specified, and we wanted one for the South Saint Am HGMP too. So I put in a number in one of the review drafts, and Dave was asking about where that number came from, and it was really just a placeholder number that I thought was fairly reasonable to start out with, but we haven't really discussed it at all amongst the co-managers. And kind of the rationale that I had was, well, right now we're putting all wild Chinook captured at Foster above the dam, and we aren't adding
any hatchery fish, and the numbers are what they are. I think they're probably averaging about 500.
Yeah.
And so I picked just a 500 number that was lower than kind of the recent returns that we've seen, where we've gone to no hatchery supplementation. But that needs to kind of be reviewed, or the agencies need to be comfortable with that, because it was just something that, that we had put in there. We want to have that threshold specified, but all of the agencies, as we move forward, the HGMPs need to be comfortable with it. So if you haven't thought much about it, you know, I've talked with Steve Marks a little bit about it. He's, I believe, aware of it, but the agencies, I mean, that's what's in the HGMP right now.
What about the North Sandy Amaranth?
Yeah, I put one in there, too, for that, but I can't remember what the number was. It may be 500, too.
Yeah, you're right. I'm going to have to go back and take a look. I can't recall. But I think it was close to that number.
So what's the path forward on that in terms of, I guess, all being comfortable with a number? I mean, I don't know if we want to wait till the next hatchery management team.
Well, it's kind of in the core's lap right now, because the number's in there, and we're just looking for a proposal in the HGMP from ODFW and the core. So if you're comfortable with it, then let's roll with it. But if not, then you're going to have to come up with your own number and propose that in the HGMP. I mean, that's a critical thing that we need in the HGMP before we move on with them. So it has to be specified kind of what's the hatchery supplementation, you know, threshold where we anticipate moving to all wild above the dams.
Right, right. And, you know, as you said, Lance, you picked a number that was slightly lower than the average return has been of natural origin fish, at least to date. But for Detroit, we don't have any threshold whatsoever like that to compare it against. But I've asked Rich in particular to help me take a look at that, because he's been working on that those issues. And so we do, as you said, the HGMPs are currently in our court, and we working on that. So guys, we'll see something at hopefully some point in the near future.
Yeah, okay. Well, and there's more biological kind of thinking that went into that besides just kind of being lower than our current return. So if he wants to talk more about that, have him give me a call.
Yeah, and I think I think that's what Rich is attempting to do, is just put a little bit of science and genetics behind some thoughts. And so yeah, we'll certainly share whatever we find with you, and he may want to follow up with you anyways.
Okay.
Anything else? All right, we'll meet again the third Wednesday of next month. See you guys.
All right, thanks.
Thanks, guys.
Bye-bye.
See you.
Bye.
All right.
I think we're 500 minutes.